For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
It's November the 24th. We are in Parshas Mishpatim. We are on page 428 at the bottom. Pasuk Tes Vav, verse 15. V'chi yifate ish, when a man will seduce, is what it says on the English side. Seduce, entice, convince. Bisula ashalo arasa v'shachav ima. So this is referring to a young girl, a girl who is under the age of majority. For us, the age majority would be, even though Bas Mitzvah is 12 years old, but for a girl, there are three stages. There is a young girl, who's called a Ketana, that's under 12 years old. There is a Na'ara, which is a girl who's kind of in between, which is from age 12 to age 12 and a half. And then there is Bogeris, from age 12 and a half and up. So this is referring to a girl who is at least under the age of 12 and a half, perhaps under the age of 12. But it's whatever it is, she has not yet reached the age of majority. And a man seduces her, and this is a girl who has not been betrothed, so she is not a married woman. She's a single girl. Vishakavima. So he has a physical relationship with her. What do we do in that situation? Mahor imharena lo liisha. So the way that the English translates it is, he shall provide her with a marriage contract as his wife. The term mahor, mem he resh, has to do with a marriage contract or that which is given for marriage. I want to hold the place here, please, on page 430, and turn back to the first place where this term is used, and that would be, we had it very recently, a week and a little bit ago in the Parsha, in Parshas Vayishlach, when Shechem molests Dinah, Yaakov's daughter, and then afterwards he tries to make it seem acceptable and tries to make it into a regular marriage. So he and his father come out and they begin to negotiate with Yaakov and his sons. And the language that Shechem uses is in Pasuk in verse.
What page?
It's on page, I'm sorry, page 182. Thank you. Page 182. 182, Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12. He says to them, Harbu alai ma'od mohar umatan. There's the same word. So he says, don't worry, I'll do whatever you want in order to marry her. So it says in the English, inflate exceedingly upon me the marriage settlement and gifts. Mohar is the marriage settlement. Here on page 430 in Parashas Mishpatim, the English is marriage contract. It means that which the husband will obligate himself in regard to marriage. That's what mohar means. So Shechem was saying, whatever you want, I'll do whatever you want. I want to marry her, and whatever terms you give me, I'll do. So whatever you want in the contract, I'll put in. That's what he was saying over here. Where we are, back to page 430, the Torah is saying that if a man does this to a young girl, so then the requirement is that he marry her. Mohor yimharena lo liisha, that he needs to arrange a marriage. It says here contract, but it means a marriage settlement. It means that whatever deal needs to be done in order for there to be a marriage, that's what needs to happen over here. Now, this is not forced upon her or her father or her family. This is a requirement on the part of the man that he is required to marry her. However, let's read the next pasuk, the next verse, Tezayin 16. If her father will refuse to give her to him, the reason why it speaks about the father, not the girl, is because she's underage. So the father is the one making the decisions. So if the father will refuse to give her to him, then what is the punishment? Kesef yishkol, he must pay money, kimohar habesulos. Like, again, here's that word mohar again, like the arrangement, the contract that is given to the besulos, to the unmarried girls. This is a reference to another discussion, another sad discussion. This is one of them, but a similar discussion which takes place much later in the Chumash, and that is about a man who actually forcibly molests a young girl. So what happens there? Well, there is there's a discussion about marriage as well, but there is, the Torah has a fine, that he is fined for having done such an act. So here the Torah is saying there are two choices. Either he is to marry this girl, or he is to pay a fine for having done what he did. Because he didn't forcibly molest her over here, he convinced her. She did it consensually, but she's a minor. So consent by a minor is not really consent. If it would be an adult, so then he's no less a scoundrel or no more a scoundrel than she is. They're both scoundrels because they were adults and they weren't married. That's the wrong way to behave. Okay. But if one, in this case, she is a minor and he takes advantage, but he doesn't force her, he does it through seduction, so then there is a choice. And the choice is either marriage or a fine. But the choice is not his to make. The choice is on the other side. It's the girl's family that makes the choice, whether it will be marriage or whether it will be paying the fine. That's the choice on the girl's side. The man loses the prerogative over here of what to do. Now, just one moment. So now, the first thing we have to bear in mind in dealing with this, and the truth is when we get to the case of molestation, it's even more important to bear this in mind, and that is that the Torah is dealing with a society that we are unfamiliar with, and it is highly unfortunate that we are unfamiliar with it. We are living in a society which is probably unparalleled. I can't speak for Rome at its height. Perhaps it was paralleled then. But the complete abandon that we live in, the abandon of any kind of requirement of marriage for two people to be involved in a physical relationship, where it's almost a given that everybody is involved premaritally, that age that we live in is an aberration. It's wrong. And the Torah is not speaking of such a society. The Torah is speaking of a society where two people who marry each other for the first time, it's their first marriage on both sides, then they have never had a physical relationship with a member of the opposite gender. This is their first time, their first encounter with a member of the opposite gender in a physical sense. That is the Torah's presumption. Now, in such a circumstance, when you have a society like that, then when someone has been involved, if it wasn't through marriage, then they are damaged goods. You have to bear in mind that a girl who was either forced or seduced into such a situation, she's going to have a very difficult time finding a husband, because the vast majority of husbands will reject her because she's damaged goods. Because no other girl is like her. All the other girls have never been involved with a man, and this woman has, and it was outside of marriage. And therefore, she will not be accepted as a likely marriage candidate. She will have to settle for men who other women don't want to marry. So she's already at a disadvantage. So the Torah here is saying that if this is done to her, the man who did it to her has a responsibility to make sure that she is cared for. And that is under the arrangement of marriage. In addition to that, and really it goes together with it, what the Torah is setting up over here is that there is no way for a man to behave in this manner without the potential consequence of marriage. And it's not his choice to make. Because if the girl's side says, we want marriage, he must marry her. This takes away from the entire experience. Because when a man acts like this, the hope that the man has is that this is not going to be a commitment. It's going to be something which is quick and it's done with. And the Torah eliminates that from a person's mindset. If you're going to behave like this, you have to understand you're going to end up with a full-fledged, long-term relationship. You better think twice before you take this step. That's why this is one of the arrangements that happens through such an action. It's not required. The girl's side can say we're not interested, and we would understand why they would say they're not interested, but understand that they may prefer that he marry her rather than the alternative, which may be that she never finds a suitable husband, or she is only able to marry somebody who himself is damaged goods. And so the Torah says, listen, you were interested in her out of wedlock, well, now you'll be interested in her in wedlock. And therefore, it is a requirement. But nevertheless, there is the prerogative on the side of the girl, her family, to say no, and then he would have to pay the fine. Okay, yes?
It's interesting that the Shoresh, the letters, Mahak, in my hair.
Yes, it comes from the same Shoresh. The same root, Mem Hei Resh, means quick, which means that we hasten the process. And it's true, we don't let this drag out. That is true. Yeah?
So a couple of things. So number one is I take offense to calling this girl a damaged goods.
She is damaged goods. Take as much offense as you want. She is damaged goods. This is not a assessing blame. It is a fact. If you have a person who is in a wheelchair, they are damaged goods. They're not bad people, and there's nothing wrong with their brain, and there's nothing wrong with them as a person. But you have to admit that some people will marry someone in a wheelchair, and other people will not.
I agree.
Right?
But I think a person in a wheelchair or a young woman that's been raped has been damaged emotionally and physically.
You're correct.
She's not good. She's a human being.
You're correct. Will a man want to marry her?
I just wanted to make that sense.
You just don't like the term goods. I understand. Yes, I understand. You're reacting emotionally, but
I'm not acting emotionally.
You are certainly reacting emotionally.
I am.
Yes. Listen,
I think I'm acting logically.
I'm stripping away the emotional part of it because you have to understand that the Torah is interested in this girl's long-term future, not about whether we're going to think of her as goods or think of her. The fact of the matter is, people who want to marry her are going to think of her in that manner. And therefore, it needs to be understood very clearly that this person set up a situation that he now has to take responsibility for.
I understand. I'm saying that actually, he's the damaged goods.
No, he's the morally damaged goods. Correct.
We live in a society that blames her. She's not damaged goods.
Nobody blames her.
We're not blaming her.
But she's being called damaged goods.
Because she is.
Calling the man
damaged
goods because his behavior.
Dr. Clary, if someone is walking on the street and another person comes up to them and cuts off their arm, the person with their arm cut off is damaged goods.
He's not damaged.
He is damaged. Of course he is.
He's a damaged.
He doesn't have an arm.
He's not good.
Would you say she's a reject? No, nobody wants to call her a reject. She's not a reject. She's a human being that's been traumatized tremendously.
And she will be rejected as a potential wife.
Okay, now that's a very different kind of
so word. You prefer reject.
She's being rejected. That's an adjective that's proper, but she's not good like a box or a table.
Okay.
So she becomes a reject.
Yeah, do you have something else to say? Go ahead.
And the other side is that, you know, I'm surprised that the Torah doesn't look at him as, he could pay a fine and be done with it. she has to live with that emotional and physical trauma for the rest of her life.
Right. That's why he needs to marry her and nurture that emotional trauma.
Well, that's what's the option that's on the table. But the fact is that he's a criminal.
It's true. So he needs to take...
So I don't understand why the Torah doesn't say this man is a criminal and he should go to jail. Or he...
We don't have jail time.
Or he should, you know, he should do hard labor. I don't know what he should do.
He should be castrated.
That's true.
I don't know about that, but, you know, he
I think
the error is putting the blame on the woman, the man.
This is not putting blame on the woman. This is rectifying the situation. I would argue the following.
Okay.
Mrs. Wittenberg, if we would follow your advice, this girl will never find a husband. This man is the most suitable husband for her. He's interested in her.
For now.
He is interested in her.
He can't just pay the fine unless the father doesn't want to marry her off.
Yeah.
He's interested in her.
He's a criminal.
Yeah.
He is the most suitable husband for her.
Oh yeah,
he's not a moral. He's not a moral and human being.
If the father determines that he is immoral, then he won't let her marry him.
Well, Jacob did.
I have to interrupt the discussion. I recognize there's a lot of emotion over here, but I'm telling you that that's only because we live in a depraved society where this sort of behavior is acceptable.
So wait.
We live in a society where it's acceptable to live like this and to go from person to person.
He did it forcibly.
This is not forcibly.
This is not forcibly.
We're not talking about forcibly over here.
I'm talking about.
I know, but you're not talking about what we're talking about.
Let's vote on whether she's being emotional.
Yes.
There's a second issue here is that why is this case presented right after animal?
Well, it's right after the four shomrim, the four people.
Like here we're just going up the ladder.
Oh, it's another.
And it shows that the girl is damaged good, but the guy is not a damaged.
No, this is another form. No, this is another.
Girl.
No, it's not.
The young girl, then after it's an older girl.
It's not after animal. It's after the cases of the four guardians.
Rabbi, there's a comment under the footnote,
yeah.
Verse 15, that answers the question that she just asked.
Yeah, what does it say?
Come right after that.
What does it say?
It says the Torah goes from instances of property theft of the heart.
Okay. I was going to say something similar to that, but okay, that's good. That's good. The point is, this is another form of damaging which is not done through an assault. That's why this is here. It's a non-assault form of damage.
Well, could a female marry that man if he doesn't marry her?
A female could if she chooses to. I don't know why she would want to.
I mean, so they're both damaged.
Or if she doesn't know he did.
Well, if he's acted immorally, and I would imagine most women are not going to want to marry him.
So they're both affected.
Yeah, it goes without saying that he's damaged morally because he did something wrong.
Yeah.
She didn't do anything wrong. The Torah doesn't have to tell us that he's acted immorally. That's obvious.
He did something criminal.
Right, the Torah doesn't have to tell us that. You're only saying this because in our society, we tend to think that acting out of wedlock is not immoral. And it is 100% immoral. It is absolutely immoral.
I'm talking about forcibly.
I get
he
that.
He didn't force her. That's the thing.
He said we're going to come to the forcibly later.
This was not a forced situation.
Well, it is with a minor. It is with a minor who does not have the ability to make decisions in a rational way. So he definitely acted wrong. In a case where the two of them are adults, then they're both immoral. In this case, he's immoral, she is not. Yeah.
What does happen when they're both adults?
They're both adults, the Torah prohibits it, but there is no...
fine.
There's no fine, no.
Oh, okay,
no.
Thank you.
No.
So, you say that... How, at that particular time, how would a man and a woman... be
be legally married? How would they go about that? They have to ask for the father for the woman.
You're talking about from Jewish men and women?
Yeah.
So then you have to go through the ceremony. You have to go through.
There's a ceremony?
There's a, yeah. Yeah, yeah. The way, same way we do it today.
Marriage contract.
Oh, yeah, contracts. But there's no chuppah.
No, there's chuppah. No, that's all in the Torah. Yeah.
And a rabbi and.
Well, you don't need a rabbi. You need witnesses.
Yeah. You don't need a rabbi narrative.
Right. Yud Zayin 17. Mechashefot lo sechaya. So we go from that sort of behavior to putting. We shall not permit a sorceress to live. It doesn't matter if it's male or female. But Harry Potter is put to death. Because black magic is prohibited, and someone who does it is put to death. We do not allow a sorceress to live. The reason why it's in the female is because there were different types of magic that were performed, and the particular one that's being discussed over here was more prevalent amongst women than men. I don't know the differences in the various types of magic, so I don't know why certain types were more common amongst women and certain types were more common amongst men. But this type was more common amongst women. That's why it's in the female. But it doesn't make a difference who performs it. Either way, we put them to death. Moving on to another death penalty. Kol shochevim behima mos yumas. Anybody who commits bestiality is put to death. It's male or female, irrelevant. It doesn't matter what kind of animal it is. The person is put to death. The death penalty over there is skila. It's stoning. And moving on to another death penalty, Zoveach lo Elohim Yacharam, one who brings an offering, who sacrifices to a god. Now this does not mean to the one god, it means to other gods, shall be destroyed. Again, this means being put to death. Bilti la Hashem levado, with the exception of one who brings an offering to Hashem. The only one to whom you're allowed to bring a sacrifice is to Hashem. If one brings a sacrifice to any other concept than Hashem, then they are put to death. So we have three death penalties here in a row, the performing of black magic, and we've talked in the past how we're not talking about sleight of hand, we mean real black magic, which really does exist. It's just that today no one knows how to access it, which is a good thing, but the person is put to death for that. Person is put to death for bestiality, and a person is put to death for bringing a sacrifice to anything other than Hashem. Yes?
This is only in the Jewish, for Jewish people. Other nations do, you know, all kinds of things.
Right. So they are also put to death for bringing sacrifices to anything but Hashem.
So this goes according to all the people.
The one of the seven mitzvos is to believe in one God. So if they worship other gods, then they are also put to death. It's just that we don't have the authority to do it under the current circumstances. The truth is, today we don't have the authority to put even Jews to death. So, but in theory, that one would apply to all of them. The truth is, all three of these would apply to all of them. They are also required to behave morally, and bestiality would also be an offense for them. And witchcraft is a difference of opinion. There is one opinion that says that non-Jews are also prohibited from performing witchcraft, and there are others that say that no, non-Jews are not prohibited in that.
So in the 400 years that we had our Beis HaMikdash, did we put anybody?
There is an instance in the Gemara that I can recall in which they did put to death a non-Jew, but I do not know how common it was. I do know of one particular case. I do know of one particular case. I was just thinking of another one, but I'm not sure that they were not Jewish. They may have been Jewish. I know of one case in the Gemara. It could be that it happened more frequently. I don't know. I don't know the answer.
There's a part here that says that if, regardless of whether you believe in Hashem or not, if you bring another offering to another god,
right,
or idol,
right,
that it's you put to death.
Yeah.
I don't quite understand if you believe in Hashem, why you would be bringing something to somebody else?
Well, because I believe.
Cover your basis?
Yeah, I believe in Hashem. He's like the super god.
Okay.
And then there's some minor gods, and those minor gods, you know, they can also help me out.
Okay.
So, you know, that was actually not such an uncommon belief.
I don't understand the definition of sorcery then, because, you know, Moshe did things that were like magic.
No, they thought it was magic, but it wasn't. It was from Hashem.
Miracles.
Well, how do they know this isn't?
How would we know whether it's sorcery or not? I'm not familiar with how it's done, but those who are familiar with, you know, in their day they understood it. So those who are doing it, apparently there were signs you could tell whether it was sorcery or not.
They brought the snakes, the Egyptians. They did the snakes. They did the
I'm talking about the staff that turned
into. Yeah, Mrs. Lishkov is asking if a Jew does a Jewish prophet does something and it's a sign from God. And God says to him, "I want you to throw down your stick and it's going to turn into a snake." So he follows what God does. How do we know he's not performing sorcery? And that's what you're asking. How do you know it's from God? I don't know the answer to that question.
And also, Joseph's dreams. Would that be?
No, that's just interpreting something. This is referring to performing something which defies nature, mm-hmm. and using black magic to do it. They would use skulls. They would use incantations. They would use various animals. They would do all kinds of different strange. Right. Well, that's different. That's not sorcery. That's a different issue. There was a trick question that I remember back in I don't know if it was grade school or high school, where one of the ways of proving that something is black magic is in certain types of magic, when you throw water on it, it ruins the magic. The Gemara refers to this in certain cases where throwing water on it will nullify the magic. So,
Wizard of Oz.
Right. So, well, they got it from there.
Yeah.
So the Gemara predates the Wizard of Oz by several centuries. So the question that we were asked is that when Paro's sorcerers threw down their staff, they turned into sticks. See the other round. Threw down their staff, they turned into snakes.
Mm-hmm.
So, in order to prove that it was just sorcery and that Aaron's was real. Why didn't Moshe and Aaron just throw water on all the snakes?
Mm-hmm.
The Egyptian snakes would have turned back into sticks because it would have nullified the magic, while Aaron's snake would have remained a snake. That would have proven that his is not sorcery because it wouldn't have turned back into a stick.
But Aaron's snake ate up the other
snake. That was their way they proved it, but why didn't they do it through throwing water on? That was the question that we were posed.
Uh-huh. God didn't do it.
That's the real answer. The answer that we were told is that the Egyptians' sticks were actually snakes. The magic was turning them into sticks.
Oh.
But the snakes were their real form.
Very good.
I don't know if that's true or not, but that was the trivia that we were asked at that time. So we have three instances of the death penalty. We move from there to Pasuk Chav verse 20, V'ger lo sonev v'lo sil chatzenu. A ger, which means a convert. Ger literally means someone who is a sojourner, which means they don't belong here. They're not indigenous to where you are. They're from someplace else. So a ger lo sonev v'lo sil chatzenu. You may not. Now these two words are similar. They use the translation of taunt or oppress. Taunt means with words. Soneh means to use ona'a, which means to. It's a good translation, taunt. Silchatsenu, which means to oppress, means monetarily, financially. So you're not allowed to taunt or to oppress financially a ger. This is true of all Jews. You're not allowed to taunt, and you're not allowed to oppress financially any Jew. But there is a special prohibition if one does it to a convert. And the Torah adds, Ki gerim ha-yisem be'eretz Mitzrayim, for you were strangers, you were sojourners in the land of Egypt, which means that you know what it's like. You were there. And since you were there, you must understand that it is a very difficult situation to be from someplace else and try to fit into a new place. And therefore, one may not cause this pain to a convert either through words or through financial oppression. the invoking of the fact that we were slaves in Egypt, we were strangers in Egypt, the point here is not that the Torah is saying that the reason why you can't oppress or taunt a convert is because you were also strangers in Egypt. What it's saying is we have an obligation to remember what we went through in order to have the empathy necessary to treat the convert properly. Which means that it's one thing if a person does something wrong. Unfortunately, we do things that are wrong. But it's another thing entirely when we have firsthand knowledge of what it's like to be on the receiving end, and then we do it to somebody else. The offense is much worse. So here the Torah is saying this in order to point out that don't think it's a minor offense. It's not just that you're mistreating a convert. It's that you were there, you understand, and you still do it. Now, why don't we say back to the Torah, that's great if you're talking to the first generation that left Egypt, but I was never in Egypt, and none of you were ever in Egypt, so at least not as slaves, not at that time. So what are we supposed to do? Why are we held accountable for having been strangers in Egypt? We never were strangers in Egypt.
And the Haggadah was supposed to...
Okay, so the Haggadah says that we are required each year to feel as if we left Egypt. Well, when you feel like you left Egypt, you first have to feel like you're in Egypt. And that's what the Haggadah does. Describe what the slavery was like, what it was like being in that land, and then getting out. So we do have each year a time when we recall that feeling. So the Torah is saying, I want you to recall that feeling when you deal with a convert, and be extra careful how you treat the convert. Moving on, in a similar vein, Kol almanav yasom lo se'anun, any widow and orphan you shall not afflict. The Talmud tells us, the Gemara says, that the reason why the Torah singles out a widow and an orphan, even though it's true, you're not allowed to afflict any Jew. So why specify the widow and the orphan? And the reason is because they are more easily taken advantage of. The widow and orphan, the widow does not have her husband to stand up for her. The orphan doesn't have his parent, whether it's father or mother, to stand up for him or her. And therefore, they are more easily taken advantage of. And the Torah therefore says that you have to be extra careful with a widow and with an orphan. Just for a moment, to define an orphan, what is an orphan?
One parent.
Well, I'm saying, what if a person is 60 years old and they lose their parent? Are they an orphan? So the definition of an orphan is losing either parent. Of course, God forbid losing both parents, the same thing, but losing either parent before the person is at an age where they are taking care of themselves. Once a person is at an age where they are taking care of themselves, then, of course, they may feel the loss of their parents, but they don't get the designation of orphan. Orphan is a person who is not yet at the age where they take care of themselves. So whether we're going to say that means under 20 years old, whether we're going to say that means before they're living in their own home with their own job, etc., whatever it is, I'm not sure exactly, there'll be a gray area there where you might question whether the person is still called an orphan or not. But just to contrast it, a teenager is most certainly an orphan, without question. A person in their 30s who's got their own family, got their own house, that person is not an orphan. So what about the gray area in between? Okay, we'll have to take each case separately to determine whether they are or aren't. But that's the definition of an orphan, and one has to be very careful both with a widow and with an orphan. But here the Torah goes further. Imane se'ane oso, if you do afflict the widow or orphan, ki im tsa'ok yitzak elai, for if he should cry out to me, shamoa eshma ta'aka, so I'm going to listen to his cry. Says Hashem to the person who would choose to afflict the widow or the orphan, that I want you to understand that although Hashem says, I generally listen to prayer, but in this case, I'm going to be extra attentive. And if they cry out to me because you are afflicting them, I want you to understand I'm going to listen. It's not going to be, perhaps I will listen. I will most certainly listen. And what will I do? V'chara api, I will become angry. That means so to speak. Of course, God doesn't actually get angry, but it means I will react as if I was getting angry. I will react like a human being getting angry. And I will kill you by the sword. I'll have you killed by the sword. And what will happen? Your wives will be widows. And your children will be orphans. So if you're going to bring pain to a widow and to an orphan, then I will take your loved ones and make them orphans by removing you from the scene. That's what the Torah says. Now, the contrast here between what happens for afflicting the widow and orphan and what happens, or the way the Torah approaches afflicting the convert, the stranger, is interesting. The Torah says, with the convert, you have experience. Therefore, I expect from you that you will behave in a more careful manner when dealing with a convert, because you have experience. And anybody with experience with pain has to be extra careful not to inflict the same pain on somebody else. That's one. Now we move on to the widow and orphan. So here, someone is afflicting the widow and orphan. Now, the person who's afflicting the widow and orphan may not have experience with it. The person may never have been a widow and never have been an orphan. And therefore, they don't know what it's like. So you can't say to that person, don't afflict the widow and orphan. You know what it's like being a widow and orphan. Who says? Maybe they don't know what it's like being a widow and orphan. So here, the Torah reverses it and says, if you're going to afflict the widow and the orphan, well, then I will make your family members widows and orphans. So you will, if you don't have experience before, well, now you'll get experience. That's the flip side of the reverse of with the case of the convert. Lest you ask that, well, what did the wife and the children of this man do? That he's afflicting the widow and the orphan, so now God is going to kill him, making his wife and children widows and orphans. Well, it's not their fault. So, first of all, it might be her fault. You have to bear in mind that the behavior of a husband may very well be encouraged by a wife. That's number one. Number two is that because this consequence is explicitly stated in the Torah, you understand that what happens when a wife discovers that her husband is acting in a manner that is dangerous to his health, to his well-being. He's smoking, he's driving recklessly, whatever it is. So a wife will say to a husband, you have to stop behaving that way. I don't want to become a widow. Mm-hmm. Right? Won't a wife say that to a husband? With this consequence here in the Torah, it will therefore encourage a wife also to, instead of encouraging her husband to act in a oppressive way towards widows and orphans, well, this way she will discourage that behavior instead of encourage that behavior. So this way it is the family unit is going to have an incentive to make sure that no one in the family behaves that way. But before we take questions on this, I want to point out what the Gemara says over on this point. The Gemara asks the following question. It says in Pasuk Chaf Gimel, verse 23, I'll become angry and I will kill you by the sword, and your wives will be orphans, will be widows, excuse me, and your children will be orphans. So the Gemara asks, that's obvious. If a husband and father is killed, obviously his wife becomes a widow and his children become orphans. That's obvious. The Torah doesn't need to say that his wife will become a widow and the children become orphans. Therefore, the Gemara says that this means something worse than being a widow and being an orphan. What it means is that they will be widows and orphans, that they will have all the negatives of being widows and orphans, but none of the positives. There's no real positive, but none of the I don't want to say advantages, but none of the silver linings, which means as follows. When a man dies, his wife can remarry. Mm-hmm. When a man dies, his children inherit him. Mm-hmm. So Hashem says, not only am I going to kill you, I'm going to kill you in a way that your wife will not be able to remarry and your children will not be able to inherit. Your wife will remain a widow, and your children will remain orphans. That's how bad it's going to be. How could that be? Because if a man is killed, and we don't know that he's killed, he's just missing, then his wife cannot remarry, because it could be she's still married, because he might still be alive. We don't know. And similarly, if a man dies, and we don't know if he's dead, then we can't just give his inheritance to his children, because perhaps he's still alive, and he still owns everything. So we can't just let his children spend the money. Maybe it belongs to him. So in the case of doubt, it's the worst possible case, because now they don't know whether their husband slash father is alive or dead, which is much worse than just the husband and father being killed. So for afflicting a widow and orphan, the punishment is much worse. There is a very important lesson that we have to derive from here, which is very, it's critical to be aware of this point. We don't, God forbid, there shouldn't be widows, there shouldn't be orphans, but it's a critical point to be aware of from what the Torah is telling us. And listen very carefully to this. Sometimes when a woman becomes a widow, God forbid, she is reluctant to remarry. And a man who becomes a widower is reluctant to remarry. Sometimes the reluctance comes from a loyalty to the deceased spouse, which is understandable. I don't want to turn my back on my deceased spouse. There's such a notion. The Torah is saying over here that this person, this man who afflicts the widow and the orphan, is going to get punished. And he's going to be killed. That's punishment enough. But it's going to be worse than that. It's going to be that it's actually going to be in doubt whether he's dead or not. So his wife will not be able to remarry, and his children will not be able to inherit. Now, if we were to suggest, if we were to posit that a deceased husband does not want his wife to remarry, a deceased husband, on the other side, really, he feels an attachment to his living wife and doesn't want his wife to remarry. If that were true, then the fact that it is in doubt whether he's alive or dead, which prevents her from remarrying, is not a punishment to him. That's actually a good thing. He would prefer that his death be in doubt rather than it be certain. Because if he's certainly dead, she can remarry. If it's in doubt whether he's dead or not, she cannot remarry. So what the Torah is then saying is, it's actually a silver lining for him. You oppress the widow, I'm going to kill you, but don't worry, your wife will never remarry because we won't know whether you're dead or not. So he's smiling because at least my wife can't remarry. You see from the way the Torah presents it over here that that's not true. That a deceased husband, I believe it's true for a wife as well, on the other side, wants their living spouse to be happy and to remarry. It is painful for the deceased husband that his wife is unable to remarry because his death has not yet been verified. That's actually a greater punishment to the deceased husband. And so you see from here that although it could be an emotional thing that a person would not want to turn their back on the deceased spouse, but you see that if you would be able to ask the deceased spouse, would you like for your living spouse to remarry, that person would answer, if we could reach them on the other side, that person would answer, yes, I would like them to be able to remarry. I don't want them to be stuck because my death has not been verified. That's painful to the person on the other side. Yeah?
Why by the sword? That must have some meaning.
Okay, that's a good question.
The spouse is going off to war somewhere, and that's why we won't know if he's...
Yeah, that's the most common reason why we wouldn't know. That's the most common reason we would know. I mean, the truth is that when 9/11 happened, mm-hmm. we didn't know for a lot of cases. That was a very difficult situation. Because it was very difficult to verify actual death. And there were stories of people, not necessarily Jewish, but there were stories of people who used 9/11 as an excuse to disappear. Mm-hmm. There were people who did that, who wanted to disappear, and they did. And then they reemerged, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years later. So, you know, what's that? Mm-hmm. That too, you know, whatever the reasons were that they
want. There's a 7 year period or some period where a person can go to court and say, they've been gone for 7 years or whatever it is. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And we'd like to declare him dead or dead. Is that, do we have that in
Europe? No, we don't have a statute of limitations. What we do have is the rules for establishing proof are relaxed in the case of a potential death for a husband. Because of the fact that a woman cannot remarry unless it is proven that he's dead, the rules for establishing proof are relaxed, and the reason is because since it really is a terrible consequence if the husband would emerge. You imagine she remarries, and then a few years later her husband, who she thought was deceased, walks in the door. Right. So it's a terrible consequence if that would happen. I mean, what's with the children? You know, it's terrible. So because of the fact that the consequences are so dire, we presume that she is going to do as much investigation as she possibly can. And so therefore, from the court's perspective, the level of proof necessary are relaxed. But it's not a time span thing. There does need to be some level of proof that's established.
You know, but the Jewish young girl, he has to pay a fine, or he must marry her.
Different situation.
She's included in all of the laws of treating people properly. This is an extra treatment for someone who has a reason to be mistreated. This girl didn't have a reason to be mistreated. She's a girl from a regular, fine family with both parents, and you know, and she was seduced. So there was no reason to have an extra statement about her prior to being mistreated. This is people who are naturally going to be mistreated because they come from less. So the Torah has to make it very clear that there are dire consequences for mistreating.
I'll digest that.
Okay. Yeah.
Did Hashem listen to Hagar and Ishmael? And he cried after Sarah convinced Abraham, though she was not a widow, but nevertheless,
Hashem listened.
The child was rejected.
Yeah, Hashem listened to him, not to her. Hashem listened to him.
But
he was evil, and so was she. I mean, he was acting in a manner that was threatening. He was threatening the life of Yitzchak, and he was acting in manners of idolatry, etc. He was evil. His mother was not trying to correct his behavior, so she was evil.
But when did Hashem listen to his prayer?
Because he was still young. So when he cried out, yeah, he hadn't yet done all of the sins that he would eventually do.
So it says, and I shall kill you by the sword. So by the sword, there has to be another human being who is wielding that sword.
Okay.
So if it's not in a war where he's, you know, he's fighting his enemies of the Jewish people, then it's causing another person to commit a crime.
Good.
And that's...
Good. By the sword seems to mean a violent death.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it seems to imply. So the way that works is that if there is a person who is out to commit a violent death, we've talked about this before, mm-hmm. then Hashem will make a shidduch. Right? He'll take the person wielding the sword and make a shidduch with the person who needs to be killed by the sword. And that's not always how it works, but it can work that way. That Hashem makes shidduchim. He brings together a poor choice with a poor choice. Someone who did something wrong and deserves a punishment with the person who wants to do something wrong and brings them together. That doesn't always happen that way, but it does sometimes happen that way. So here, that would be what this would mean. But if no one chooses to wield the sword, which would be a good thing, that means no one's choosing evil, so then we say Hashem can take care of himself. He doesn't need our help. And if he wants this person to die by the sword, he'll figure out a way to have him die by the sword without a human being choosing to kill by the sword.
Why do you get the idea that his death will not be verified? You couldn't verify his death. Well, where does that come from?
That, so as I explained, that was what the Gemara says, that the fact that it says that he'll be dead, we already know that that means his wife will be a widow and his children orphans. So the fact that the Torah emphasizes it is to tell us that it's going to be worse than regular widow and orphans, but rather that they will not be able to act like a regular widow and orphans, and that she will not be able to remarry, they will not be able to inherit, which means that his death will not be verified.
That's the only way you'll
pay. Right. But otherwise, they would be able to, she should be able to remarry, and the children should be able to inherit. Right. Now, just to focus a little bit on this, on the progression here, that we have the three death penalties that we mentioned, which are, we would call them pretty serious offenses. Sorcery, well, since we don't know about sorcery, it's hard for us to think about how serious that offense is. In our day and age, it's been glorified through the previously mentioned icon. But the truth is, it's actually a terrible sin. And the bestiality, we can all understand, is a terrible sin.
What is that exactly?
That's having a physical relationship with an animal. And idolatry, well, that's probably the worst thing one can do, because it's rejecting God completely. So you have those three. Following on the heels of those three, you have the affliction of the ger, the convert, the widow, and the orphan. So here again, it would seem that the Torah is trying to emphasize to us that afflicting the widow and orphan is very, very serious, and the convert is a very, very serious thing, and a person needs to be exceedingly careful. When people speak publicly, as I often do, others do as well, so it's difficult sometimes to speak publicly about certain things. And here we have a fairly small group, and it's a group which I don't know every single one of you and all of your histories, but we know each other, and we can hear things from each other, and we can accept things from each other, even though something may not be exactly perfect. When a person is speaking publicly and you don't know everybody in your audience, so it's very difficult to speak about sensitive issues and not hurt somebody, so that when one speaks, for example, about a one is at a is speaking at a Sheva Brachas or at a wedding and speaking about the beauty of marriage, well, there are a lot of people in the audience who may have had difficult marriages, or maybe going through difficult marriages, and speaking about that can be painful. And if one is speaking about for whatever reason, talking about a person with a wonderful upbringing and loving parents and a stable home, and there could be people in the audience who became orphans, who don't have stable homes, or whatever, you know, it can be very painful. One can inadvertently cause pain to a convert, to a widow, to an orphan. It's not hard to cause that pain if you don't know who you're talking to. And because people don't walk around with a little badge on their collar that says, "Hi, I'm a convert," or "Hi, I'm an orphan," or "Hi, I'm a widow," you don't have that. So what the Torah is saying, you've got to be exceedingly careful. That means that the burden is on the speaker. The burden is on the person who might cause the pain. If the Torah wouldn't speak so strongly about it, then one could have argued, listen, I'm going to treat people like I treat everybody, and if it turns out that if I find out the person's a widow, if I find out the person's a convert, well, then I'll be extra careful. But as long as I don't know, well, I don't know. But the Torah is shifting that burden. The Torah is saying, listen, you have to be careful. If you don't know, then you better err on the side of being careful. And that's a lot of responsibility. And it's not uncommon that people become more careful when they realize that the person has been going through a rough time with this, that, or the other thing. But until we know that, well, we treat them as regular. Regular means I don't have to take their feelings into account so much. Whereas the fact of the matter is that most everyone, I should say everyone, has some pain, something in their background, something that they went through, something they're going through, and it's very easy to exacerbate that pain. And the Torah here is really saying that it's our responsibility to anticipate that pain, rather than to find out about it after the fact and say, oh, how could I have said that? I didn't realize. The person has to anticipate the pain and the difficulty people go through. The Torah singles out the convert, the widow, and the orphan. But the Torah, it means anybody who's gone through these sorts of things, a person needs to, if there's any kind of specific pain a person has gone through, then a person has to take it into account. And so we will conclude by acknowledging the point that Dr. Clary made earlier, which is that people could have gone through the type of situation that was described earlier in the Torah, and therefore, if one uses terms like damaged goods, which could cause pain, and you don't know who you're talking to, well, it's possible that you're causing pain. So the Torah is saying you have to anticipate that sort of pain, and therefore I acknowledge the points you made, and that we shouldn't use, or I should not use that term, and rather just say that the person is damaged. We don't have to use the term goods, because that would make it a little bit too mundane and would diminish the person's humanity. It's a very good point. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.